So I'd like to call the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council meeting to order. Welcome to visitors. It's a record show that we do have a quorum present for the meeting. Everyone has an agenda in front of them, but I thought since we do have a new member of the council that it would be a good opportunity for all of us. We've had a chance since 8 o'clock this morning for many of us to get a chance to meet Senator Folby and talk to her, but I think it would be a good time to introduce ourselves and who we're with, where we live, just so that Lisa has a better understanding of who we are and where we come from. And by the way, we are informal when it comes to the committee. We don't do senator and representative. So, and I'll maybe we'll start with Heather down at that end.
Origin unknown.
Ryan Bronson, I am Conservation Program Manager at Oak Grove Ammunition.
Hello. I'm David Harpel from Minneapolis. I run a manufacturer.
Wayne Inger, County Executive Director for the Farm Service Agency for the east half of Otter Tail County. So welcome to Otter Tail County.
Darby Nelson, retired college professor.
Greg Knopf, Senate Analyst.
Bill Becker, Council Staff.
Mike Kilgore, Chair of the Council, and I'm a faculty member at the University of Minnesota in the Forest Resources Department.
Bill Ingebrigtsen, self-explanatory. I can't be called Senator, so how about Governor? How's that?
Okay, Governor Ingebrigtsen.
I'm one of the few that's not running.
Oh, I'm Lisa. Sure.
That I'm not running, yes. Yeah.
Sandy Smith with Council Staff.
Scott Rolf from Worthington, Minnesota, operating independent investment firm.
I'm Jim Cox. I'm from Fallon, Minnesota.
Bob Gunther from Fairmont, Minnesota.
Lisa Fobey from the Princeton area. I actually live in Zimmerman, but in the Princeton School District, have served in the Senate for 2 years. Senator Betsy Worgan had the seat just prior to me. She resigned from her position. I was elected in a special election, and I serve on E12, Policy and Finance, Environment and Natural Resources Policy, and Ag and Veterans Policy and Finance. Just prior to serving in the Senate, I was a stay-at-home mom for 15 years, who served on the School Board of Princeton for 8 years, and also on the Minnesota School Board Association and the Minnesota State High School League. I'm not quite up on my vocal where yet. So I have three sons, 14, 17, 19, and am married to Dr. Enrico Fragoni. Live on a small lake, shallow lake, compromised lake, in tough shape. So really involved with my lake association. My background's in social work and psych. I do a number of different things between college and the Senate, and we can get caught up on some of that later. So it's great to be here. It's a privilege for me to be here. Senator Ellen Anderson, when she came and broached it with me, I just shocked because I know there's a number of other senators that would like to try it, but she had some specific reasons why she wanted me, or she thought it'd be a great fit for me with my district. My district includes Elk River all the way up to about 3/4 of the way through Lake Mille Lacs. So I have quite an environmental area, hunter, fishing, habitat area, so it fits with my area and my lifestyle.
Great. Well, Lisa, welcome. And I know that you talked to Senator Anderson recently, Ellen, and obviously she regrets the decision she had to make. She enjoyed her time on the council, but we look forward to working with you. So great. Members, we have an agenda in front of us. One change that I would like to make is on item number 8. It's not really a change, but that is a decision item. So if you would just note that item number 8 does require a decision of the council. Besides that decision item, we have we're going to hear about the 25-year framework planning process, and we'll be asking for council action on that. And Judy Groof from Management Analysis and Development is here to talk about that process. Then the other decision item that we have is, which is a very important one, is to adopt our 2012 call for requests, which has been in the works here for some time. So those are the agenda items that require a decision. We have some other things as well. Members, are there any changes to the agenda as proposed? If not, a motion to adopt the agenda as proposed.
Move to adopt as proposed.
Okay. Any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We have an agenda. The meeting minutes from January 7th, it's been almost a half year. It's hard to believe. Les, did you have a...
Oh, Nornis, Representative Nornis.
Oh, welcome.
Hi.
Welcome.
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 You're ready.
All right.
We'd like to join us.
That'd be nice.
Minutes from January 7th, the last meeting of the Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council. Any changes to the meeting as drafted?
Move approval.
Further discussion on that motion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Meeting minutes are adopted. Next item, number four, is the Executive Director's Report and the session update. And I know Bill's going to spend some time walking you through some materials to highlight the outcomes of the session that just ended. Before he does, though, I just want to say two things. One is that Bill and Sandy and Heather just did an outstanding job, in my opinion, working the bill that was drafted by this council last year, or in January, through the process. I can tell you that I would get an email or a phone call from any one of them at any day of the week, literally almost any hour of the day. They put in a lot of hard work, a lot of time to make sure that legislators understood our bill, understood our the rationale for our recommendation. So that's one thing. I just want to let you know how much work that our staff put into that. And the other thing that goes hand in hand is I heard several times during the legislative session from both senators and representatives how much they appreciate and respect the work of our staff, which is really great to hear. We're a new entity out of the chute. But from both sides of the aisle and from both bodies, I heard individuals comment to me personally how much they respected the work that the staff did and how much they appreciate the integrity and the forthrightness of this group of three that really represented the council, I think, quite well. So I just wanted to let you know that they really were working on our behalf, and I, as chair, really appreciated their hard work. So thanks. And with that, Bill, I'll turn it over to you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Wayne.
Does that call for five attaboys?
I think it does. Yes, yeah, I think so. Thank you.
On behalf of the staff, I'd like to thank you, and I'd like to extend the staff's appreciation to Janelle Taylor and Greg Knopf. Without whom we couldn't have done it. And the late hours that they put in and the hard work were really appreciated. And I think made the difference in many critical ways. Switching gears a little bit, it was quite a session, but I must say, compared to our first session, it was a walk in the park. At least we weren't putting the recommendations together at the same time the legislature was taking place. Just a piece of business. You'll note that in the agenda, item number 9 is public comment on uses of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. We had two people contact us, Brad Mergens and Darren Newville, who we expect to provide some input at that point in time. On the table over on the side of the room are these cards. At your leisure, feel free to go fill one of those out if you want to speak in the public input portion. And slip that card to Sandy, and we'll get you on the list. That being said, I'd like to turn to the session report. And in your packet is a stapled document on white paper that's titled Session Report, Lasard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council 2010 Session Report. And we're going to go through basically three things. We have provided a summary of the most relevant sections of Chapter 361, which was the Conference Committee Report on Senate File 3275 that contained the council recommendations. We're going to just very quickly, I'm going to show you what our new statutes look like. We won't go through them in detail, but the statutes were amended in the session. They'll look different in the future. And then we're going to take a quick look at Chapter 392, one small piece of it, and updated on expenditures. This is a very limited session report. There are other things that we'll get you information on as time goes by. For example, the LCCMR recommendations, I think you all ought to know about that. We'll get you a summary of what happened with a few small items in the Clean Water Fund. And okay. So if you want to open up to the page one of the session report, I'll go through, first of all, how this is set up in the first section. And you'll notice at the bottom of page one, two columns of the document. In the left-hand column is the council language as it went out of the council to the legislature, and the column on the right is the conference committee report. The highlighting in the left-hand column are basically things that were either stricken or changed. The right-hand column pretty much corresponding the addition or change that was made to accommodate what the council was recommending. The first change that I want to point out to you is on page 2, and it's in 2C of our Heritage Fund, and the term or successor was struck, and on the right-hand column, there's change that is occurs throughout the document. The Commissioner of Natural Resources must agree in writing to each proposed acquisition. So you'll find those changes throughout. So you can see in 2D or its successor in 2E in writing. The next substantive change would be found on bottom of page 7. With the Conservation Partners Program, the word pilot was stricken. The sentence, the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall give priority to organizations that have a history of charters to receive private contributions for local conservation or habitat, was not necessarily stricken, but its location and what it said changed, and I'll get to that in a minute. And then there was a change in the program shall require a cash match of at least 10%. Looking at the right-hand column, you can see that the first change of significance in addition was the change in the match, where a two-tiered match was provided. The program shall require a match of at least 10% from non-state sources for grants of $100,000 or less, and a match of at least 15% from non-state sources for grants over $100,000, and up to one-third of the match may be in-kind resources. So there was a significant change in the match requirements. In addition, the criteria were, it was stated that they should be applied in a balanced and equally weighted order of precedence. And then,
you know what that means?
Yeah, but I believe it means that you don't give more credit to one than the other in the form that you put together. Balance being equal, being equal. The language substituting for the first change in council recommendations is the next one, which basically says that subject to the balanced evaluation criteria, the Commissioner of Natural Resources shall give priority to organizations that have a history or charter to receive private contributions, et cetera. And basically that makes the historic use of money and raising money for conservation a deciding factor in roughly equally weighted projects. And then is the first instance that I believe of a change that was requested by the council after our recommendations were put together. And it adds to the places where restoration or enhancement projects may be made to land permanently protected in conservation easement or public ownership, or then the change, or in public waters as defined in Minnesota statute section 103G. 0.05 subdivision 15, which is the definition of public waters. And this was just to clarify what we thought was council intent. He wants to do restoration and enhancement in public waters. The Department of Natural Resources had determined that our language would not allow that, and this was a clarification for that. On page 9 is the next significant change, the Sard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council site visit exception. You'll see over on the right-hand side that that now is in section 97A.056, subdivision 5, which is amended to read as you can read in the right-hand side. The important thing here is that no longer will we have to put this exception in the session law. It is in the statutes. I think it's important to read this and understand what it means, that we have to make sure that travel to and from is scheduled and publicly noticed, and that it's not a violation of statute to receive information, but it clarifies that we still can't make a decision or agree to make a decision during travel, which I hope we have not done. Availability for appropriations. The appropriations were extended in this particular law over what the council recommended if they are restoration or enhancements. The discussion in committee raised some concern that it took more than 2 years to do a suitable restoration or enhancement, and the money ought to be available for longer. The major impact of this is, I believe, frankly, an accounting impact. It will allow program managers to use the money in the best possible way over time. Subdivision 9 on page 10, paragraphs B to I was changed to this subdivision, which is just a clarification. There were two additional project requirements that were brought into play with regard to conservation easements, and specifically to specify the habitat types and locations being protected. We assume that that's being done in a conservation easement, but this makes it clear in the law. And then to add a requirement of a conservation easement that it promote water quality and water clarity by retaining water on land as long as practicable. A technical change at the bottom of page 10, the highest quality conservation was changed to current conservation science. Likewise, on page 11, the best available science was changed to current conservation science. You can see the public waters extension of the restoration and enhancement projects at the bottom of page 11. Beginning on page 12 and going over on page 13 is the statute dealing, or the law dealing with land acquisition restrictions. This applies to money appropriated from the Outdoor Heritage Fund in this bill that is used for acquisition. And the major change is that the council, need to notify the chairs of ranking committees and the ranking minority members, of the legislative committees and divisions with jurisdiction over the Outdoor Heritage Fund at least 15 days before we make a decision to approve a transfer of property from one individual entity to another. This is sort of a fair warning, fair information approach, and is a good change that we supported. You'll recall, going on to page 14, you'll recall that the or successor was stricken from the left-hand column every place that it occurred. It is substituted by subdivision 15 in session law, which gives the council the approval over any successor organization should an NGO cease to exist. Going on to page 15, we'll talk about the council recommendations part of this section. This part amends council statutes to instruct council to consider a range of options for restoring, protecting, and enhancing, and rely directly on the constitutional language while considering recommendation options. It also reaffirms the main document's guiding recommendations and the need to show a direct relationship between recommendations and constitutional outcomes. Just as an aside, the way I read this from my discussions is that what the intent here is to rely directly on the constitutional language and let each individual on their own determine what that constitutional language means, whether it be an applicant or a council member. So, if you have questions about that, this is a critical change.
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Bill.
Not a question, just an observation. That's where we originally started out. Is that correct, Bill?
With
the constitutional language
that
was changed?
And
so it's back to where it was.
And
correct.
Greg, indicates to me that the final conference committee report may not have had item J in it. We'll double check on it. It doesn't. So strike the part about in blue where it says it also reaffirms, and strike the line at the bottom of the section.
So just can you go through that again and get the strike outs?
Paragraph J at the bottom of page 15,
okay.
Delete that.
Mm-hmm.
In the blue at the top of page 15, delete from it also to outcomes. Is this one of the technical changes that took place? This may crop up again. There were 7 technical changes from the conference committee report, and I don't think that we finally were able to track those well. Section 5. The following section codifies the ability to receive information in transit. We talked about that a little earlier. The following section requires reporting of revenues earned and uses thereof from land acquired and transferred to the state with appropriations from the Outdoor Heritage Fund. With regard to the use of constitutional funds, there's some question as to whether or not entities have the capacity to purchase property and receive income with state funds and receive income from it before turning the property over to the state. This is a piece of statute that will provide information to understand exactly what's going on in that situation, if anything. Then on Section 7, the bottom of page 16.
Excuse me, before we go on, Bill. Scott, question.
Back to that, Bill. It basically requires a reporting, but at this point in time it does not restrict that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Section 7 at the bottom of page 16 defines when publicly owned land may be purchased with Outdoor Heritage Fund proceeds, requires the decision to approve such purchases to have 9 positive votes, and requires the council to notice the Legislative Coordinating Committee prior to considering such a decision. This was a compromise from an outright ban on the purchase of land in public domain, and I think is procedurally a good change. We'll have to work with council to figure out how this works with our overall recommendations process in the event we were to have a proposal that up front proposed this. It requires 9 votes for us to
vote. Greg, because that was a question I had. When we have a program that we're funding, and let's say there are 10 projects in the program, we're making a recommendation to the legislature with at least a vote of 9. But then on that one project, how do we handle that particular one that might be a purchase of property that has a sliver that's in a permanent conservation easement?
Mr. Chair, the way I would see this is when you're approving, you're right, when you're approving the recommendations to the legislature, it takes 9 votes anyway, so that's 9 vote for a margin. But how I see this working is when the accomplishment plan is before you. If there is an acquisition and you're approving the accomplishment plan, you should have 9 votes on that accomplishment plan. Excuse me, I'm trying to say that. That's the way I would read it, is when you're actually approving that plan.
Okay. And we have to notice it 15 days before we discuss it.
Mm-hmm. The page 17, restoration evaluations. The following section requires an evaluation of sample of restorations using technical evaluation panels of professional conservationists. It limits the amount of the Abra Heritage Fund available to finance the evaluations to 0.1% of the forecasted receipts of this fund. This is the agreed-upon compromise to legislative audit and restoration audits.
Yeah, one thing, and it's to make sure people are very clear. This does not provide an appropriation to do this process. The legislature would have to appropriate the money. So I'm assuming how this would work is you're making, when you make a recommendation to the legislature, you could recommend up to 0.1% of the funding go toward this. But the legislature would still have to appropriate the money. That last sentence in there, it does not appropriate the money. It's only guidance as far as the limit, but it does not appropriate. It would still have to be appropriate for this purpose.
Okay.
Section 10 on page 17, land management recommendations, directs the executive branch to recommend to the legislature ways to implement reasonable management of acquired land regardless of source of acquisition. This is part of the result of the legislative auditor's work. Repealer, this is section repeals the application of the statutory definition to all legacy funds, and then in repealing the 84.02 subdivisions 4A, 6A, and 6B, repeals the definitions themselves. Article 3, which is the Clean Water Fund, has some things that are relevant to us. Section 1 requires the Department of Finance to use the power of the indirect cost plan to reimburse the legacy funds, the general funds for the act, excuse me, the general, you should, using the legacy funds, the general funds for the actual costs incurred auditing expenditures of legacy funds. So the legislative auditor begins by using general funds, finds out how much it costs to do the financial audit, and then the legacy funds are tapped. And it applies to all of the funds, parks and trails, clean water, arts, culture, heritage, and the outdoor heritage fund.
Bill, a question on that. Is there a cap or any guidance on how much that might be coming from each fund?
There's guidance, and the discussions that I've had with Auditor Nobles is that he's guessing in the $60,000-$70,000 every 2 years. I think that's probably what he testified to in the committee as well. And I think that the history of his estimates is it's fairly accurate.
Is that Jim, or is that from each fund, Bill?
That's from each fund that has a two-year audit.
Is
David?
Is that part of our administrative budget with the cap, or is that outside of our administrative budget?
We'll start out by interpreting as being outside our administration.
But I don't say this facetiously, but and I know that the legislative auditor wouldn't do this, but there could be, the way you read this law, couldn't the legislative auditor create the Cadillac review process and then bill the fund for $500,000? I mean, I guess that's where I'm going.
You do it once. You audit the
auditor. Well, Greg? The chair of the Commissioner of Management and Budget does. This all has to be approved. But there's a regular process for this Commissioner of Management and Budget overseas. And everything, I mean, there has to be a clear trail that this money being spent for this purpose. And I think you can trust the legislative auditor not to too much on it. I mean, basically, the fiscal note said $66,000, as Mr. Becker said, every other year. And it'll also have access to those other funds to do this part. But it is, I mean, it's in your statute that the legislative auditor is required to do audits of the fund. And this does pay for it. And it's a regular process that the auditor actually, I think even without this sentence, the legislative auditor would have been able to do this anyways under current law. This just makes it abundantly clear the process that's used.
Okay.
And I think also you would have put, you wanted to come out of administrative expenses, you would say, of this amount will come out of our administrative.
Right.
He doesn't usually stop miss much that way.
Yeah. So the section 4 on page 18, this affects the legislative guide, and it permissibly limits the legislative guide to the House of Representatives, so the House doesn't even have to adopt it. I guess that's what that means. It's a House committee. Let's see. At the bottom, the section sets a schedule for adoption of a common logo for the legacy funds. Just as a little background, we are on record with the Arts Board is asking them where the logo is. I sent a letter a month and a half ago. We've got projects that are actually purchasing and completing acquisitions, and they're asking about how to sign those acquisitions, and the sign is supposed to have the logo on it, and there is no logo. So there is no sign, there's no sign, there is no credit, there is no understanding of how the money is being spent.
What feedback are you getting from the Arts Board on your request?
Not much.
Any?
No.
Scott?
One of the questions that came up, and I don't know if the decision was made, but remember, the language says that all the projects have to be signed. Is there going to be an exception for easements where a private landowner retains, you know, trespass rights and all of that? I mean, we talked about if they sign an easement, people will perceive that that's open to public hunting.
Right.
Is there, have we talked about that, or is that anywhere?
That's an issue that I have not discussed yet or come to analyze.
Conclusions. Okay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that could be, it's got a huge problem.
We could make sure that any signs make it very clear it's private property not to be developed and protected by a conservation easement, instead of just, I mean, we could be pretty specific on the language.
Well,
Greg?
Mr. Chair, if you look at the language, this is basically what you have for the logo. And that sentence that starts after the new language, where it says a recipient of funds, basically says that where practicable, a sign logo would develop into the section on construction projects. So during construction, if it's an easement, but it's being reseeded or whatever, so during the construction period, and then it says, and then at access points. Well, if it's not accessible to the public, you don't have an access, as far as I can read. That's the way I would understand.
And it may not be practicable either.
But you don't have an access point. This is where you do have access.
Right.
If there's not access to the public, I assume you'd only need to put a sign up while you're actually doing the work.
So, on page 19, if there are no other questions there, funds carry over. This section just clarifies the availability of all legacy fund 2009 appropriations, specifically that they expire either in 2011 or 2012. Use of carry forward. This is particular to the legislative auditor and allows the legislative auditor to carry forward general fund balances and use them to provide seed money for legacy funds audit. So we were talking about the $65,000 that might come out of the legacy fund. First, it would be expended from the general fund carryover for the auditor. Then they would keep detailed records of what generated that $65,000. Then the repayment would be made. Repealer, this section repeals the requirement for the legislature to develop or adopt 25-year plans for the legacy funds. In Article 4...
Hey, Bill, before you go on to Article 4 on that repealer, what's your take or staff's take on the implication of that, that repealer? Because we have the charge to the council to develop a 25-year framework. Then you had in Article 5, Section 9, the legislature developing a 25-year strategic plan, which is no longer in place. Does that change anything?
I think it changes the presentation of the 25-year plan that we put together, in that we simply present it to the LCC. As requested, we would present it to committees, but we're not required to commit to present it. Does council have any other?
Mr. Chair, not really. I think the thought behind repealing it was that we kind of, the legislature might have indulged itself in a little bit of overplaying in 2009, and there was some concern that each committee having to do this. I had always assumed that whatever the plan that came out of SART stands off for Heritage Council would then be adopted by the committees recommended it. But there's really no reason to do that. And so I think the legislature just decided that there's no reason to go forward with that, that as long as we've got a 25-year plan going on for each of the four funds, we might as well just use those plans as strategic plans for the fund.
Thank you.
So to go on to Article.
Oh, yeah, excuse me. Bill?
Greg, maybe a question. Section 8 here, can you explain that a little better to me? The House of Representatives is now being charged with the committee guide. What exactly?
Oh, Well, Mr. Chair,
Greg,
Senator Anderson, the Senate had this repealed in their bill,
mm-hmm.
and this just recognizes the fact that the House committee had spent some time going through the guide, and rather than repealing it all, it basically says that a committee guide may be developed by the House of Representatives Committee of Jurisdiction over Culture and Outdoor Resources because of all the work that they had done in putting together that guide. But it's still it's a committee guide. It's not a guide for the legislature. It's for the committee. It basically was kind of a compromise over the senators.
Shall we move on?
Article 4, the Department of Natural Resources long-range budget analysis is essentially a ways and means analysis for managing five classes of public lands that are defined in Minnesota Statutes 86A or the Outdoor Recreation Act. There are a few other classes of lands that aren't included in this. Page 21, just for your convenience, we've attempted to engross the changes into our statutes. We've gone through this. I think that the major change comes on, first of all, in the recommendations. I don't want us to lose track of the requirements for our recommendations. But then at the end of our statutes, with the addition of subdivisions 8, 9, 10, except for J. On 23 and 24. So if you would strike paragraph J, recommendations made by, this is that technical change error that we didn't pick up. In addition, we provided for you a small section out of chapter 392, map data on expenditures. And this section guides the Department of Finance to consider producing an interactive map relating projects to the programs and related expenditures. I think I've distributed our start on that to you all, and we should have this forthwith on the website for our phone. And those are the bulk of the changes. This represents the bulk of the changes that affect the council in the last legislative session. I would ask council, House Council, or Senate Council if there's anything they think ought to be included that's a major importance to everybody else.
Great, Janelle. Any other questions from council members? So the good news, as Bill said, is the recommendations that this council made regarding expenditures of outdoor heritage funds for program for the second year in a row were not changed, and I think that's great news. And the changes that were made, I think, are going to help. I think they enhance. They provide more clarity, more accountability. So I think the changes that we see before us is really a very good set of changes. Bill?
I think there's one other thing that's worthwhile mentioning. Over the last year, we have from time to time gone on record in writing with council decisions or reasons for council actions. And I think that serves us well. And I have as a case in point the transmittal letter that went to the Speaker of the House, the Majority Leader, and especially the Governor, that explained the context within which we were making recommendations and the substitute mm-hmm. issue. It's clear, it's important that that be clear to everybody that we're out in front of the process and that we, for example, in this case, are assuming that what we're doing is is a supplement to all of the decisions. So I wanted to...
Yep, that's a very good point.
One more question.
Yes, Bill.
Bill, maybe going back to page 16, so we're going to have 9 positive votes. They're all going to be recorded on every acquisition that we do from this day forward. Is that what that means?
No.
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 8?
The accomplishment plans.
You're speaking of...
We have to approve the accomplishment plans with 9 votes.
If this condition exists, right.
Or if someone comes in with an amendment to an accomplishment plan that envisions acquiring a parcel that is in part or in whole, land in public domain, this statute kicks in. We have a supermajority and a notification so everybody understands what we're doing. And personally, I think it's a good compromise, and I think it allows people to understand what's happening, and that's important.
Jim?
I'm just curious, Bill, do you think without the definitions that it's going to change the types and scope of proposals that we're going to see in the future?
Over time, maybe.
Well, heard a sigh over there.
Mr. Chair, that Greg? Could be true, but it kind of depends how you write your request for proposals. I think it's just that you don't necessarily have definitions determining what types of projects are coming in, but you can still narrow down what your document is asking for. If you're asking this year for certain types of projects and next year for different types of projects, I still think you can include that in your request for proposals. I mean, the definitions were a shorthand way of doing that, but I still think you can do that.
Bill?
And I would add to that, which I think Craig's absolutely spot on, but I also think that our emphasis on programs really defines in large measure the types of things that we see.
Jim?
Well, I mean, the real crux of the deal is the protect definition, I thought. And, you know, it got into acquisition, and did it include things beyond acquisition? You know, if we start seeing, you know, 30 proposals next year for invasive species, I mean, we really can't say those aren't constitutional anymore, are not part of our request for proposals. I mean, if someone wants to broaden that definition now, I mean, we're going to be required to see all these different proposals that people think are proposals that have to do with protect outside the definition that we used previously.
I believe so.
Any other questions? Okay, if not, let's move on then to talk about the meeting schedule. It's a good segue, Jim, that question. Item number 5, Bill?
I'd like to turn this part of the meeting over to Heather to run through the schedule for you, just to remind you that we found that it's important at each council meeting to bring you a schedule of future meetings so that you can recheck your calendar. And there are a few changes, not in dates, but in the subject of a particular meeting, for example. Heather?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My apologies before I start to Senator, have not been privy to the future council meetings nor your availability, so I hope that several of you, or all of you, have received emails from either Sandy or myself in the last several weeks querying you about whether we would be able to attend the meetings in the next couple of months. And you've heard back from most of you about that. But these were dates that have been settled on this year, given your respective schedule. So I'm hoping that for most of you, this still will work out. The next meeting of the council will be in just a couple of weeks, and we will be meeting in the Worthington area for field trips. We hope to we'll have a meeting in the same business meeting in St. Paul before we leave for the Worthington area. On the way down, we'll be stopping at the Swan Lake to get some marsh reclamation there, and make our way down to Heron Lake. We'll be spending some time there looking at that area, and also having a public meeting in the Worthington area that evening. The next day, we'll be traveling north on our way back to St. Paul, and en route, we'll go to Pheasants Forever acquisition in Cottonwood County, and then up to the Whispering Ridge AMA acquisition up here in New Ulm, also stopping at a SNA, the Tower SNA there to look at some projects. There is a Conservation Partners grant program around Heron Lake, and also up near the Whispering Ridge area as well. At that meeting, we'll be having a couple of presentations. Jim Nobles from the Legislative Auditor's Office will give his OLA report that he gave several times to the legislature this last session. We'll have a brief presentation from the Minnesota Forest Resource Council and the work they've been doing in mapping the needs in the forest regions of the state. We will continue talking with consultants about the 25-year plan, the 10-year plan of the council. also have a presentation from a joint presentation from the Department of Natural Resources and Bowser on buffer strip. The big piece of business for the council will be reviewing and adopting the accomplishment plans, and we're in the process right now of just putting final touches on those and getting those out to you prior to the meeting. In July, on the 1st of June, we will be putting out the request for proposals of the outcome of legislative session. It will be a 45-day period before those are due in the middle of July. We'll be talking a little bit, hopefully more about that in just a future agenda item here. There is a proposed site visit to is offered, or we were invited by the Rendell County Soil and Water Conservation District to gather some more information on the needs in that area. There will be a joint canoe trip with the LCC Water and the Water folks.
I'd like to point out that we've authorized travel on that particular occasion. You should have received that notification. So if you decide to go and meet with the Clean Water Council and the LCCMR at Renville County, we'll arrange to pay your mileage and other expenses that you incur.
In July, you'll all be receiving a very large packet in mail with all the proposals that we've received for your review. In August, we'll be spending our time reviewing those proposals and writing them. On the 6th of August is the deadline for proposal ranking, and on the 16th we will meet as a council to review those proposals and also review them ranking and select those programs that we'd like to learn more about. If there are any other kinds of council amendments that need council approval, we'll be looking at those as well as updates on the 25-year plan and conservation. Really important meeting at the end of August on the 24th and the 25th, when the council will meet to hear presentations from program submitters. We hope, not knowing at this point in time how many proposals we'll be hearing, I think it's quite a long day, three full days. First of September, the council will meet again to discuss the proposal merits, determine the allocation, continue to talk about your plan update. The council will meet on the 15th of September. This is a very important meeting where the council will make allocation selection meeting, application selections, and again, update the various programs that we mentioned before. On the 28th and the 30th, or I believe we haven't quite settled on it, but it's either the 28th and 29th and the 30th, the council will be doing a joint trip with the LCCMR, and those will be trips to see projects or programs in the metro urbanizing section. We have not yet planned that out in any great detail.
Heather, the reason it's 2 days is the evening before we're going to bring in Dave Mulla of the university to talk about precision conservation and evaluation of lands. And then we're going to go out the next day and see some examples of that work. So
the presentation the night before will just be of the council, for the council, and the field trip will be joined with us. In October and November, then we start back up and preparing for the next legislative session. Preliminary accomplishment plans and do a preliminary analysis. Council will meet on November 4th, although Sandy, are we changing that date?
No, that's the Thursday after election, so we're in the clear.
To review draft accomplishment plans that we'll be doing and look at some of the preliminary analysis, review the plan, and updates for the CP health program, and also any kinds of dates are not set yet, either the 6th or the 7th of December, for another council meeting to review the appropriations language and final analysis of the same, and then final bill approval on the 15th of December. And then we take a short rest and start the next legislative session.
Thank you. So, Heather, do you or Sandy or Bill have any idea about
the Conservation Partners Grant Program, their cycle, their timing, when their call goes out. Do we have?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Grant. Did you hear the question?
Yeah. I don't actually know when their call is going to go out.
I spoke with Leslie Tannehill at the first stop today and about this, and they need the accomplishment plan approved in June so they can get the request for proposal out in July. So they're a little bit ahead of where they were last year.
Any comments or further questions of staff regarding the schedule from here to the end of the year? We're slowly moving up the process. Les?
Henry, you said the November 4th meeting was potential change?
No, we had talked about the election
is Tuesday the 2nd, yeah. So Thursday the 4th.
This is a day that works for nobody, so equally.
Okay, the December one, that's not set yet.
Question is the December 6th or 7th, and that, my understanding is no. Well, it'll be one of those 2 days, but okay. That date hasn't been set.
That's right.
Our goal here in the schedule is to try to give us as much time to prepare before the session as possible to do a really good analysis. I came on to it early December, right, sort of in the midst of it. I had one day after 2 days of council meetings, and to me it was a very hairy business. But what I hear from Bill and Sandy, it was much the same as before. So we're trying to get ourselves time to be better than Bill and ready to go the sessions.
All right. Thank you. Hearing no further questions, let's move on to agenda item number 6. And for that, we've asked Judy Grew from Management Analysis and Development Division to talk with the council and explain the proposed process for developing the 25-year framework. Welcome, Judy. Note, members, that this is an action item of the council.
Good afternoon, everyone. For the Management Analysis and Development Division of Minnesota Management and Budget, my name is Matt for short. We're the state's in-house management consulting group. We do management consulting projects for state, county, and local government, higher education, and in Minnesota schools, essentially the public sector and in the state of Minnesota. Many of you might recognize me or members of our management analysis team. Last year, we worked with you throughout the summer to engage groups, our conservation professionals, and public input groups for a first round of four-year planning process. And we concluded that with a two-day meeting with you last September. We're continuing along with that process. And I want to just give you, first of all, an update on what we've been doing to get started with this. This is the spring of this year. Then we'll run you through the essential framework for funding for the next 10 years and 23 years of the council's funding. And then a little bit of what we as a working group, which will assist you, might need from you as well. And then any questions, comments, or concerns that you might have. First off, since the spring of this year, what we've been up to. I met with the Wasartan staff, the council chair, Kilgore, and legislative staff to review the planning process from last summer and fall. We reviewed what worked well, what needed improvement, and we reviewed a list of recommendations that we had made for the planning process going forward from what we had heard from conservation professionals and some of our own analysis of how the process went last year. At the conclusion of that meeting, the council chair and executive director asked us to prepare a proposal for a process to obtain feedback from some of the major state and federal agencies in the conservation community on how to conduct a framework planning process for the future. The first thing we did from there is we convened a leadership group, leadership from the DNR, the Board of Water and Soil Resources, the Pollution Control Agency, the Department of Agriculture, the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, and the University of Minnesota. With that group leadership, we reviewed the council statute and section laws governing the planning process, and we sought their commitment to assist us in this effort. We obtained recommendations from leadership of those agencies for members of the advisory to deploy this process going forward. We moved on and we met twice with that advisory group to help discuss a workable process to develop this framework. At those meetings of the advisory group, Council Chairman Kilgore presented a straw man proposal at that meeting to get the advisory group started, which he claimed he sketched up during the Twins game. But we all thought it was a pretty comprehensive and well thought out proposal, and much of what the advisory group adopted is very similar to the initial straw man proposal that Chairman Kilgore has presented. From the advisory group, we obtained some high-level advice on how to conduct a planning effort. We got advice from them, for example, on appropriate economic assumptions that we might want to use for 10-year and 23-year funding estimates. If we're taking, in trying to make some assumptions of how much revenue might be coming into this fund, and what kinds of projects might that enable you to fund, what types of assumptions should we be making about inflation? What types of assumptions should we be making about trajectories of land values, for example? These are the people with the expertise to point us in the right direction and to give us some simplifying, estimates and rules of thumb for advice. They also provided us with a great deal of feedback on developing output and outcome measures. Outputs are fairly easy for you to identify. You can protect an acre of land. But in what circumstances and what ways can you identify the outcomes that you might be able to achieve by protecting the acre of land? Where can we quantitatively identify impacts to different species, duck populations, pheasant populations, for example? Where is the science good enough where we can say if you protect a parcel of land of this size and conduct a project of this nature, where can we reliably predict and identify impacts on the species and populations? In some cases you can do that, and in some cases it's more qualitative guesswork. But they provided us with advice in that regard. They also talked to us about the extent to which some of your objectives can be quantified or identified quantitatively using simple spreadsheets or GIS computational modeling. And then there are some areas where those efforts just need to be qualitatively identified. Finally, we obtained recommendations from that high-level advisory group on planning and analytical staff. And this is a group who can roll up their sleeves and really develop this framework and get the analytics and the work done to describe it. Once those members were identified, we have already met once with the recommended staff of the working group. With that group, we are right now still in the process of developing a specific work plan and staff assignments. So it's kind of like a bus that's been rolling along here, and new people have been getting on the bus as we go along, and we've been describing to the newcomers each time, providing them with a few hours of context and where we are and where we're going. So we've only had a chance to meet with that working group once. We'll be meeting with them again next Thursday. So that's what we've been doing behind the scenes. I want to review with you the components of the funding framework that we've developed. And I understand that these were in your packets or handed out. At the top it says Framing Outdoor Heritage Fund CAPCAT Outcomes 2018 and 2034. For our audience members. I'll start with the first page and just describe to you the funding framework and what it would look like. At Chairman Kilgore's guidance, I think the first thing we want to say at the outset is that there's a difference between a funding framework and a strategic plan. A strategic plan identifies your mission as an organization, your goals and priorities, and what it is that you want to achieve, and sketches out your key strategies and how you might want to get there. A framework, however, identifies for the amount of funding that you might be receiving, how might that map out into the future. The way we're looking at this, you have already identified the strategic components of your plan. You discussed last September, and you've been discussing throughout, what your priorities are for the state, and your specific goals and priorities and what you want to accomplish for each of the ecological subsections. we're not going to have this group or any other groups supplant or replace that work. Strategic planning, identifying vision, mission, and goals is the role of this council. The role of this process for the funding framework is putting more analytics, numbers, and for examples behind that framework, and showing both you and showing the public what might be accomplishable with the resources of this fund. There are three basic elements to the framework that we would like to map out for you throughout the summer and into the fall. One is a baseline habitat outcomes and outputs, and that is the scenario that we would develop that would show you what could be expected if the Outdoor Heritage Fund had never been available to fund conservation work. And with declining state resources and fewer funds, that actually might be a declining baseline scenario. We felt that was important, however, for two reasons. One is for the public to understand that this fund is not the only game in town, that there's a lot of different conservation work going on, both in the public and nonprofit and private sector in Minnesota, and to give the reader of this funding framework a sense of what one of our advisory members called the conservation state in Minnesota, to just kind of describe that. Another reason that identifying that baseline is important is going to help you tease out your value added as a fund from the base of the work that is already ongoing and that we can expect for the next 20 years will be ongoing. You might recall last summer, since we only had about 8 weeks to conduct our planning, we collected that information as one basket. We brought the conservation professionals together and just said, what can be accomplished? And let's talk about that regardless of funding source. Let's think big. Let's talk about what we can accomplish together. So in that process last year, we didn't tease out the baseline from the value added from the fund. This summer, we want to move on and try to tease out for you what's in the base and where is your value added. That second scenario, the likely habitat outcomes and outputs, that is your value-added scenario. And that is the level of outcomes and what might be accomplished if the Outdoor Heritage Fund's appropriations are kept relatively level. And we're going to use an assumption from the first 2 years of appropriation and sort of move that trajectory forward with an assumption from your first 2 years of funding of sort of a blended approach to identifying projects from the various sections, different types of habitat work, and just bring that out for a 10-year trajectory and a 23-year trajectory to show you what that looks like and what, after 23 years, you might be able to accomplish. The scenario C is what we've been calling the maximized habitat scenario, and that will describe to you some different levels of outcomes that would be achievable if the maximum funding needed were dedicated to one particular habitat. So to the extent practicable, we would say, let's take that whole funding basket, which now, and in the trajectory for your 2 years of funding, you spread across different types of habitat work. Take that basket of funding, push it all in the forestry direction, push it all in the wetlands preservation direction, push it all into prairie work, push it all into other habitat work. To kind of show, it's essentially a sensitivity analysis. It's showing you if you move from that to your trajectory in various ways, what those scenarios might look like. Chairman Kilborn identifying this maximized scenario has made very clear at every meeting we've held up until now that none of those maximized scenarios are scenarios that you would actually fund. We wouldn't, by any stretch of the imagination, take the entire resources of the fund and place all of those eggs in any of those baskets. But it's just kind of giving you a sense, if you move those investments in one direction or another, what that might look like. Another value added of that maximized scenario might be to give both you and members of the public an idea of what is maximally accomplishable with the resources of this fund. We had a member of our advisory group and other people who have spoken to us have said people might have unrealistic expectations of how far $80 million goes. And if we can just do some reasonable estimates to show what can be accomplished. That might help with managing some of the expectations for what can be accomplished. Those are essentially the three scenarios that we would like to lay out to you. And we anticipate that will take us throughout the summer and into the fall for a work team of professionals to put together for you. What we're requesting from you as a council, first thing, as we've discussed, the appropriate role for the council is to identify mission, values, vision, and goals. And where our working group, in looking at that two-year funding trajectory, if they're trying to move that forward, they might also want to see qualitatively what is it that you're trying to accomplish in each of those ecological sections. You already mapped that out in your call for request last year, and in your meeting agenda for this year, you have identified your goals for the various sections. We just want to check in with you to make sure that those goals that you've identified for the sections are fairly durable, and those are assumptions of your goals that we can use to do a 23-year funding trajectory for you. Another item that we were requesting from you is your review and approval of these three scenarios as essentially the framework and the way you might want to have us approach the framework. And finally, the necessary funding to continue the effort throughout the summer and fall. We prepared a preliminary estimate that's in your packet, and it's a high-end estimate of approximately $145,000. That estimate is assuming that management analysis is doing all of the work. We are a revolving fund operation. We charge for our services. However, we've been able to get volunteer work from a number of agencies, and we'll be able to replace hours that we had planned on working with some volunteer hours from an assortment of agencies on the working team. So that would be our higher-end estimate, and that is the action I'm in front of you for approval today.
Bill?
And I just wanted to point out that MAD charges on a billable hours as a basis, so they're keeping track of their time. This is not a simple cost estimate.
Okay.
Did anyone have any questions about the framework, about the process that we've been going through, throughout the screen, about any of those scenarios?
No, I think, Judy, the important thing that you mentioned, and I think bears repeating, is that this framework is different than the work that this council will do every year, at least until that changes, to develop a call for request that lays out habitat priorities in each of the five LSOHC sections. The framework you're talking about is not that. It won't replace that. It won't replace the role of the council to identify those priorities, review requests, and make recommendations. As I see this framework, the value of this framework is providing stakeholder groups, citizens, ourselves, a way to over time evaluate how we're doing and be able to track progress based on three different potential, well, not the third one, I guess, is a potential outcome in some respect, but three different trajectories, and to see where we're going and where we've come over 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 23 years from now. So to me, that's where the greatest value is being able to look over time to see how well we are actually doing as compared to a couple of different trajectories of where we could be. David?
I'm curious if the third scenario, which is everything into one deal, is because we clearly aren't going to go there.
Right.
Is that really to allow us at the end of the time to say, within this forest framework, we could have gone here, we weren't going there, but we got 25% of what was possible? Is that kind of what we're trying to do? I'm confused as to what all that work really gives us.
Well, my take is that it shows us an upper end bound, and to some extent it would do what you described. You know, I know when this group first met, they talked about literally an infinite number of scenarios between there and a baseline. And so to get around to developing an infinite number of scenarios, this would really show what is possible. And it's really bounded by, number one, the availability of receipts to the Outdoor Heritage Fund every year, and number two, the capacity to do this work. So the capacity includes willing sellers if it's easement or fee acquisition. It's capacity for natural resource professionals to do restoration and enhancement work. So that scenario is not just a quick multiplication, but it has to be grounded by those two factors, the amount of money available and the capacity to do this work, including the supply of either land or habitat to do this work.
So how finely do you dice it? You know, if you look at forestry, for example, are you talking about forestry across the state or forestry in the northern part of the state or forestry in the Minnesota, Mississippi River Valley? I mean, where do you draw the line, I guess? It becomes confusing to me.
Well, to the extent practical, we need to do this on our planning LSOHC sections. That's our instruction.
Okay, so if you do it on our sections, and just use forestry, take me through your thought process on forestry, you know, you could spend, I don't know what the upper end is to do your work, and you still wouldn't have enough. So how do you divide it within your sections if you're talking about forestry is putting all of your money there? Is there a way to divide it?
I see where you're going, yeah. You know, and that's going to require some professional judgment about, for example, if the capacity of this upper end was using $50 million a year for forest restoration, protection, and enhancement, your question is how do you allocate that amongst the northern forest, the southeast forest, the prairie transition, and metro? And, you know, there are a number of ways you could do it. You could look at the availability, the amount of forest land in each. You could look at capacity related to the amount, or you could just combine that with professional judgment and say, you know, we think 40% would go in the northern forest, 30% would go in the southeast, and so forth. It's a good question. I don't have an answer to it.
Yeah. And we would use some of the principles from your first 2 years of funding as a guide. You have been distributing the resources and the projects between the sections. In the forestry example, we do have the advantage that the Minnesota Forest Resources Council has already identified some of their highest priority forest projects. And so if we have a limited amount of funding, even in a maximized scenario, we could say, well, apply those to where the Forest Resources Council has identified the highest priorities. I believe you'll be hearing more about that process next month at your meeting. So there are some ways where we could use plans and documents that are available that you prioritize. There are also a number of planning efforts that prioritize prairie work. So if you go to existing and other plans and try to get a sense, if we do have more projects than we have money, well, how would we allocate that? Again, that is not a replacement or a supplantation of your annual decision-making process, but it's just how could we spatially or visually map out for you in each of those sections what you might be able to accomplish in 23 years
On this point, though?
Yes. One of the other tools we have to work with is we've got a significant GIS presence built into this. So some computer analysis of the distribution of resources and the condition and that sort of thing, I think would be useful.
Wayne?
Will this process help us to satisfy that legislative requirement for council accountability on projects?
I think it, not on a project basis, and by project I mean a particular restoration, but I certainly think in a grander and more important way helps to communicate what the council's considered, what the council considers the objectives to be, and gives us something to measure against, and thus is in a grander scale an accountability issue, or measure, I do believe that.
Well, the question comes up frequently, or I hear about it, the government, and any type of government spending more on studies and proposals than they do of actually putting things in the ground. And I want to be able to tell somebody there's a good purpose for this because it proves the accountability of where we're spending our money and we're doing it with a purpose. And to me, I think that's what people want to hear.
And I think that the fundamental thing that we're looking for is to, on the broad scale to make decisions on what the highest and best use of these funds are. That's when you go back to what Judy was talking about earlier, the value added. It wasn't set, but my assumption is that the council will make the decisions to maximize the value added by the investments.
I was just reading that legislative requirement in the back. I wasn't a part of the legislative process during the session, but that requirement looks like a retrospective evaluation by technical professionals on where the project's accomplished in hindsight. So your engineer is a prospective, you know, how can you possibly frame this out or do this work? So I wouldn't see the prospective work as substituting for that evaluation process, which would happen after that.
Darby?
Yeah. I've got a couple of questions. Are we going to see addressed anywhere in any form, for example, the question of the division of money amongst the five regions? Are we going to in any way touch that, or are we going to deal with that year by year, sort of depending on projects that come in? And a very parallel question is the same thing for each of the forest, prairie, you know, wetland habitat. Are we just leaving that sort of wide open at this stage? Are we at some later point going to do something about that, or are we just going to sort of let it happen as it may or will?
Well, my response would be that a bit of both. That that second scenario is really a trajectory of what we have funded or what we have recommended for funding over the first 2 years moving forward. So to that extent, you could extrapolate the types of things you're talking about. But I would say that this is not going to be our this will not replace our ability to review or our need to review proposals that come in and make decisions that are based on our best judgment as a council to the legislature on where to fund. So, for example, I could see in an out year, I mean, this council, maybe 5 years from now, decides it wants to do a very large, just like we did with the Forest for the Future, investing $40 million, let's say, in the restoration of a major waterfall lake, you know, something that I'm just dreaming. But that's the prerogative of this council to make those recommendations. I don't see this process constraining that ability in any way, shape, or form. Bill?
And you have to be in a position to fund the best available projects before your programs before you. So I don't think that any a priori division is something that we necessarily want or will have to hold to. I think that what we're doing is setting up targets and seeing whether we can get the right programs to meet those targets.
Okay, so we're really not going to do what some other individuals, the smaller plans that we worked with a year ago, in which you say, okay, you know, by 20 up to 25 years, we will have protected,
right,
you know,
right,
what is it, 90,000 acres of native prairie or whatever,
right,
and so many acres of this and so many acres of that. we're going to basically not address that and essentially say whatever the projects come in that we're going to, which you really are the best ones, are the most strategic ones. And I'm not arguing either way. I just want to get a sense of kind of where we think this all is going to, what's going to address this.
Mr. Chair, I think that there's one additional piece of information that the council needs to think about this, and that is the context in which all this planning is being done is 25-year framework, 10-year goals, 5-year evaluation. So we're saying this is where we'd like to go, and we're going to come back in 5 years and see how we've done and adjust those 10-year goals and our objectives. And that appears to me to be planning process with the legislation that we're dealing with this Senate. And so it's an adaptive process. and depending upon what we can get in as proposals.
Bob? Bob?
Mr. Chairman, I think, as I recall, conversations about the LCMR, and I'm not sure if the LCCMR has the same deal. They would announce, basically, what areas they will be funding the next year. Mm-hmm. And the thing that I believe that we do is we take and listen to all the projects throughout the strata, and we pick out what we think is the most important fund, regardless of where they fit. So we did pick the forest because we thought that had an emergency. Mm-hmm. So one scenario could be that eventually to reach our 10-year goal after a 5-year evaluation, we could go and say, okay, we have to focus more on prairie restoration, for example. That could be a way we could go around this. And I don't think copying anything from the LCCMR is a bad thing to do necessarily either.
Or we could change the goals.
Or we could change the goals.
Right? Ryan?
Is the working group that's going to be advising on this, is a roster of that available?
Yeah, I have one here with me today. I can just get that to you. We have
electronic version. I'm curious because I suspect a lot of the folks that are involved in the working group are probably involved in projects elsewhere. I mean, disclosure of that is in everyone's best interest.
Yeah, just for the record, could you read who those people are, Judy? And then we'll send that to every member.
Myself and Peter Butler for Management and Access. Peter met last year. He was our spreadsheet jockey during the meetings. He's going to be doing a lot of the budgetary work. Ryan Brown, a wildlife biologist who works right here in Denver, as follows.
He works for Rex Johnson.
you might be meeting him in the next day or so. Tabor Hope, you'll be meeting tomorrow. He's a project team leader from the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Heather is on the team, and Leslie McKinley, an information specialist from the Minnesota Forest Resources Council, and Andy Holtzwood from the Department of Natural Resources. One thing we struggled with was there are so many experts at the DNR, and we didn't want to end up with a team of 20 people. So Andy's going to be helping us with being the point person for the DNR, where we need DNR expertise or data to try to help us locate and, you know, find the right data, find the right professional who can give us the information that we need to try to kind of keep the team process fairly lean. Some other folks who will be consulting as needed, who won't be necessarily doing the heavy lifting on the project, but who might help us locate other professionals, data, or advice. Jeff Risker from the Pollution Control Agency. He has been involved in the clean water planning process, and he's been providing us with valuable information on how these two planning processes might intersect. And he might be able to advise us as well on where will we have complementary outcomes from the Upland Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund, and where are we going to potentially get some two-pers for different types of projects or work. Dennis Simon, the Wildlife Section Chief of DNR Fish and Wildlife Division, along with Andy, he'll be helping us locate people within that division who might be helpful to the process. Rob Sipp, an Environmental Policy Specialist from the Agricultural Development and Plant Assistance Division at the Department of Agriculture. He's going to help us locate, the Department of Agriculture has a number of GIS and planning specialists who might be able to give us data and information on agricultural lands and how they might intersect with council priorities. And Stephen Taff, an associate professor of applied economics at Curtin University. He is somebody who will be consulting on how to make some of those assumptions. If you're trying to assume what will land values be 23 years from now, well, how do you do that? What type of assumptions can you make? What type of sensitivity analysis do you need to do about that? Professor Taff is going to help us with some of those estimates. So that's what we have so far. Karen Kilgore, Bill Becker, and Sandy have also been part of the process.
On this point?
Yes.
Bill?
And one of the criteria, the major criteria we used was that these were public employees, university, or agency, and not NGO private employees, to try to avoid as much as possible the conflict of interest, the theory being that the public employees are civil service, and as opposed to having...
They're in the same competition realm, though, as the NGOs. I mean,
we've provided an opportunity in the process for others to become involved. But we think that forging the beginning of the framework ought to be done by public employees.
I'm not sure I agree with that entirely. I think a mix would be far better than just public employees. I agree with Ryan. There is everybody's in this to get something out of it eventually, or would like to. Public employees or NGOs, I think there ought to be a little broader mix.
We've decided to mix it up, but a little bit different way, instead of horizontally, linearly. And we're specifically assigning time and place for that to occur.
Scott?
This working group, are those people receiving part of as comp, part of the cost of this? Or are these costs MAD's costs, and those people are contributing because they're not?
Judy?
The resources from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the Minnesota Forest Resources Council and Water and Soil Resources are donated. Peter and I, of course, since we are revolving funding to charge for our time, as well, the coordination piece that Andy will be doing for the DNR, that's going to be such a significant time commitment for him that they're asking for some reimbursement for Andy's time. Likewise, if we need to get assistance beyond what we have in working, most of the GIS shops around the state, whether we go to the DNR or whether we go to the Geographic and Demographic Analysis Division, the Department of Admin, or if we go to Butler, almost all of those units charge for their time. So the way we did the estimate for you was a high bound estimate, assuming that management analysis consultants are doing the work. Since we do have a lot of these volunteer resources coming in, we're expecting that the ultimate price tag will be less than that. That's been kind of difficult as we've been going around along years to figure out which of these resources come with a cost and which ones are donated. And figuring that out as we go along.
Any further questions of Judy? What we need from the council is a motion to authorize this process to go forward, including the expenditure up to the $145,625 that has been drafted. Again, that's an up to, and it's based only on actual hours worked on the project. It's not a fixed fee contract. Darby?
Before we leave and make a decision there, I'm just wondering if I can ask a question that's a little bit off of what we've just been talking about.
Sure.
So, I mean, I can...
Yeah. Yeah. Is it related to this?
My question was simply this. The Nature Conservancy's prairie group is working on essentially a strategic plan, 25-year strategic plan for the prairie, and I'm wondering how does that, if it does at all, enter into what we're talking about here?
Yeah, good question. Bill and I met with Tom Landwehr on that very issue. Bill, you want to just...
I think that we take that into consideration on page 3 of the handout that Judy gave us, going over onto page 4. And we're aware of these sorts of things happening, and the intent is to take into account other ecosystem-specific planning efforts. So they would be treated very similarly to another species plan and taken at face value and evaluated by our people, our experts.
Yeah, in that group there are a lot of experts.
David?
Curious if anybody else is as concerned that I am that there's only government employees in this and not any NGOs anywhere represented.
Before we go on to that, I'd just like to point out that on page 3, the first bullet under other consideration,
I saw that, Bill, but that's advisory to this group. It's not part of the group. Personally, I think sitting at the table, having a little broader representation would be wise. But that's just me.
We can do that. Let me just give you my personal thought on that. And that is a reflection based on what the criticism that was leveled to the arts community for their process. And if you remember, they were heavily criticized for bringing the potential recipients of the arts fund, to the table to help craft the plan, which will then guide the expenditure of dollars. And I didn't want to see the Outdoor Heritage Council getting caught in that same trap of having all the stakeholders who, you know, I mean, I hear it not all the time, but, you know, these people have, they have something to gain by being a part of the process.
But
we have them as
part of these people, their agencies have anything to gain?
They certainly do, but I think it's a different level of accountability than a nonprofit. That's my own take. But it's up to this council. If this council feels that it's in the best interest to bring in others in a more formal way than on an advisory kind of feedback role, that's something we can do. We got Jim and then Wayne.
But Mike, this document here is just a list of basically outcomes. It's not setting priorities. It's not determining how the money's going to be spent. And I guess that's the way you want it to be. I mean, this is basically not a roadmap, but how far we could go if we went in a straight line, 60, 70, or 100 miles an hour,
right,
is basically all it is. There's no direction whatsoever in this document. Or am I wrong in that?
No, that's a pretty good characterization.
Okay, so, I mean, to have NGOs in here, they're not going to be having any determination on how the money's spent. They're just going to be giving us an estimate of how far we could possibly go. And I don't think there's any kind of conflict of interest in.
Wayne?
The one thing we always got to keep in mind is organizations such as Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Turkey Federation, Deer Association, whatever, there's nothing for them to gain. They're nonprofits. They provide a service. You look at where all that land comes from. They're not landowners for the most part. It all gets given back to the state of Minnesota. So there's very little outcomes that they actually get. So I think in many respects, a lot of people look at this as a part of the process. Well, if being part of a process that puts more prairie on the ground and creates more pheasants I don't consider that a bad thing.
Okay. Bob?
You know, I was at the meeting, the first planning meeting they had in New Ulm, and I went there just to find out what in the world they're going to do. How are they going to come up with this plan? And I was very impressed with the fact that they had a roundtable, and they went through it. They asked questions, and they had a person there writing down what their decisions and ideas were. And I thought they were very comprehensive. I didn't think there was a lot of biases by the people that could have had biases, but they weren't there. Because there was some counterbalance right there with them.
So let me just ask all council members, is there anyone here who has a strong objection? I mean, I'm hearing a very strong sentiment that as needed, the concern I have is the number of NGOs and others is not endless, but it's a lot. And we don't want to create a committee of 20, but to give Judy and staff the ability to bring in others on a more formal basis as needed. Am I hearing any member of the council saying that's not a good idea? Because I really don't want to take this into a formal action, but to really help guide Judy and staff as they develop this. Now is the time to speak up.
Are the meetings right? Open? I mean, can they can be the NGOs can monitor and
yes.
And also, it's part of our data collection process. I should mention within the work plan that we've been developed so far, in order to identify that baseline scenario from which you're adding value, we're going to need to reach out to those non-governmental organizations and say, what are you doing? What are your plans? Tell us about your 23-year scenario, so that we can build that comprehensive baseline. So we were planning on working them into the process, both in the data collection and in the comments on the plan. We were just thinking, though, for the folks who were sitting down and doing the GIS work and grabbing the data sets and doing some of the modeling, well, most of those data sets are sitting at the DNR and Bowser and elsewhere anyhow. There are people who have access to that information. And then there was that issue that Mike mentioned, that there are a number of nonprofits who take a lot of heat from the press and others. We're having been part of the planning process and then afterwards having received funding.
But that
and that created trouble for the NGOs.
That was really a group of just NGOs.
Yeah.
I mean, it was 100% NGOs.
It's not the same situation.
Well, no, there was the art board. It was there. And I mean,
it was almost 100%.
Yeah. Well, I'm hearing no dissent, so I think, Judy, that's the go-ahead to, as you see on an e-base, bring others in more formally into the process. I'd go back to, we need to authorize this process to continue forward as we've described it, as well as the expenditure from the council budget up to that amount. And we'll be getting updates from here on to the end of the year at every meeting from Judy and or staff about the progress that's being made. So with that, I'm looking for a motion.
I move.
Okay. So, Bill?
Can you restate the
yep,
motion?
Please.
The motion by Councilor Rawl is to approve the MMB plan and budget for the 25-year planning process.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion has adopted. Thank you. Thank you, Judy, for driving up this far. Next, yeah, I'll bet. The next item, number 7, actually has three components. The first two are going to need action by the council. The third is not an action item, but a discussion. So, Bill, do you want to introduce the first one?
The first one is the treasurer's proposal. I'm going to turn it over to the treasurer. But I just wanted to, before I turn it over, say that the reason this is before you is that we need a number for the cost to let people know approximately how much money we will have available. And this will be reviewed after the November forecast and finalized.
November for the RFP?
Yes. We term it the call for a cost.
So this number, whatever it is, can change in our final allocations.
So, turn to your little sheet that says treasurer's proposal. And I think Bill said it best. This is to give us a rough number that we can let people know what scale that we're going to put out the RFP for. We will have more information before we have to actually make decisions. But if you're looking at this, you'll see the income side first, which is summarized with net receipts, which is the important number, which is the fourth number down, fifth number down, I guess, which if you look in 2010, is estimated to be $75 million. I think it's important as we go forward to 11, 12, and 13, we realize we're not even done with 2010, and we're talking about, you know, where we're going to be in 2012. So this is, who knows where the economy is going to be. This is speculative. We're going to have to make a hard decision when we get to our actual allocations as to, based on the best information, what do we think we should do that's safe? Because we never want to get to a place where we are allocating and recommending allocation for money that doesn't come in, because then you're going back and undoing an appropriation, which is ugly.
In the event that that happened, wouldn't those appropriations that were approved just have to wait a month or two or six till the money actually became available? If we were a million long, or
my understanding is no, because it's appropriated out of a specific period of time, and so you don't get to roll balances forward and allocate it in the future. You don't get to roll deficits forward. So you could actually have groups that have committed to spend the money, and there's no money there, and the only way to get it is to get the legislature to, in the future, allocate for what was missing, which would be perhaps challenging.
Bill, the budget of the state of Minnesota has to be balanced, and this is part of the balancing. These revenues have to cover the appropriations made. And if the revenues fall below the appropriations, you can't go get more money, so you got to cut the appropriations.
So if you just look at 2010, for example, we estimate at this point $75 million as a net receipt. We appropriated $69 million, leaving us with $5.5 as a reserve. That 5.5 was more than that when we did our work. It was really 10%, not 8%. So there's been slippage from what we allocated, but because we took a conservative approach, we didn't fall into a trap. That money will be available after the books are balanced in August of this year. We will know what that really is, and then we can decide what to do with that. So when we want to carry that forward, that would carry forward into our 2012 numbers because 2011 is already allocated. So, you know, what we're recommending we look at in 2012 is just under $85 million, and 2013 would be just under $89 million. This is based on the best current information that's out there from the Department of Revenue as to estimates of revenue. I'm sorry,
$86 million.
And I'm sorry, the recommendation is $86 million and $88.5 million in 2013, leaving some money on the table for reserves so that if there's slippage, we don't have problems.
Bill?
So if I understand this correctly, the 84,887 is our receipts in the tax year. We add to that our balance brought forward from FY10 of the $5,542,000. That gives us $90,429,000 available, of which we're recommending $86 million be appropriated in our recommendations, leaving a balance for the fiscal year of 4,429% or 1,000 or 5%.
Yeah, it's holding to the 5%.
Right.
Yeah. But I think we have to have another conversation based on where we're at in November in terms of the final sort of numbers.
So we need a
recommendation would be 86 and 85. This point.
Okay. And so since we are making recommendations on a yearly basis, the key item for this discussion is for fiscal 12. In our call, we would list that approximately $86 million is anticipated to be available from the Outdoor Heritage Fund for fiscal year 2012. So that's a motion, David?
Well, I would like to hold the motion until after we have the discussion of C, because if we have a discussion which leads us to talk about 2 years, then we'd have to come back to this motion.
Shall we go ahead?
Sure. Okay.
I'd like to answer any questions, if there are,
sure,
any, about the schedule, the way it's put together. Does it make sense to everyone?
Mm-hmm.
Perfect.
Yep.
Good job.
Yep, makes sense.
Okay.
The question then of 2-year appropriation cycle comes up. And in order to fairly and squarely change to a 2-year appropriation cycle, among the things that ought to be done include noticing that in the call for proposal when we're going to make that change, if we were going to make it. The advantage to sticking with a 1-year cycle is that it clearly meets the statutory requirements that we have in 97A.056 to make recommendations on an annual basis. It provides more continuous accessibility to the funds, allows us to be more nimble. The disadvantages of staying on an annual cycle include the lack of predictability of funds on the part of recipients. It includes being out of sync with the normal 2-year budgeting process. And it makes it more laborious for the council and the recipients to apply on an annual basis, here on an annual, present and here on an annual basis, plan on an annual basis. There are alternatives as well to either doing a two-year cycle or a one-year cycle that include things like for specific programs, making a two-year recommendation of not spending all the money available in the second year, using the second year allocation to amend or increase appropriations to projects that were selected or heard in the first year. There may be other alternatives. Any of staff have thought about them? Appreciate volunteering, of course. But I think that's essentially what's before us. We may want to do a combination effort. We may want to, for example, say that it's appropriate for Conservation Partners to have an allocation out of each fiscal year. We'll just get that done. They can run two cycles. Then retain the remaining balance to be administered on a smaller RFP basis or call for request basis. So those are the general reasons and approaches that one could take on a one or a two-year cycle. Just one notion. We can report our recommendations every year, even though we've run a two-year cycle. I'm not sure that that's full faith with the statutes, and it would certainly make it clearest if we had a statutory change with regard to what the cycle is. I'll leave it at that, and perhaps there's some questions.
Got the questions, Wayne and Scott?
Actually, I just want to see if I've got straight. What we're talking about is putting about a call for requests that would encompass 2011 and 2012 all together at one time. Or 12 and 13, excuse me. All at one time. Then this fall, October, whatever it is, when we review them, we'd be reviewing them and putting them in categories with the top ones, for instance, and get 11 or 12, and the other ones would go to 13, or we would have to decide this group is going to get fiscal year 12, right. This group is going to get fiscal year 13, and then we would have to come back together and check to make sure that all the money got expended in 12 and projects are going. If not, then that money would carry over to 13, and we'd have to call a special meeting to then find more projects, to allocate more dollars for the leftover projects. Is that kind of in essence where we're going?
No, I don't think you'd have to do that. I mean, the other funds are all doing two-year allocations, so you can just say, you know, put in for forests 2 years worth of requests and fund it over 2 years and figure out a management of the cash flow with that. You know, we're all for acquisition, and they could get it done in 6 months, you'd have a problem. But if it were for restoration, it's going to be spent over a period of time anyhow.
Mr. Chair, if I recall, we discussed this last year, the first year, about doing that. I think the decision was that I'll at least give it a couple of years so we can do it, make sure we're doing this,
right.
Make sure it works 1 year at a time. And so far, I mean, I've seen the process working pretty well. So.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's got some merit.
Scott?
Well, the two-year appropriation thing might have lots of rationale from a organizational point of view. I would be against it for a variety of reasons. One of those would be, we always said that we want to fund projects that could be lost. Okay, if all of a sudden we fund for 2 years, our funding cycle's up for 2 years, and something is identified, that's really good, that will be lost. okay? We have no ability to be nimble and fund that in our next funding process because we've committed for 2 years. The second item that I see is if an organization comes and says, okay, we're going to fund you for 2 years, okay? I've always told people that call me, I think the folks that have the best chance of being funded next year are the people that did the very best with the money they got this year, okay? Which means if you act fast, if you get done what you promise you're going to get done, and you then can come back a year later and say, this is what we've accomplished. You know, you gave us $3 million, and we've committed $2.1 million of that. We are getting it done. Okay, we can see what happens. But when you go to a two-year funding cycle, you're going to get to the end of 2 years before you really figure out, is that organization worthy of getting some more? You know, the other thing about a two-year funding cycle is if you have an organization that had a good project, just didn't rank high enough, went back, made some changes to that project, if they have to wait 2 years to apply again, they may very well get disenfranchised along the way. You know, I didn't get it, now we can't apply for 2 years. You know, they kind of lose the inertia. You know, and so, and the other thing that happens is if you have a new organization that comes and applies that has a limited track record, you're really not going to get a look at that, at how they did, until your two-year funding cycle is up. I would like the opportunity at the end of the year to come back and say, okay, we have a new pot of money. How did you do? And continue to reward the organizations that are getting the work done, be that a public or private or NGO or whatever. And two-year funding cycles, I think, make that a lot harder, too.
Darby.
I'm just recalling discussions that we had in round one, early in round one, about the 1 year or the 2 year. And I personally don't have strong feelings either way, but I remember some of the argument or some of the discussion, and that was too hurried. The impact on staff, the impact on us, it was just too concentrated an effort, and there was real concern that we lose opportunity for field visits that we would otherwise get if we did have a two-year cycle. Bill, I guess I'd ask you, I mean, is that, how do you feel about staff pressures if we were to continue a one-year, an annual process?
Darby, you've asked us at a very difficult time. We've basically been in operation for a year and a half, and we're in our third round. So we're feeling tired. There's no doubt about it. But we don't know. I was counting with the meetings that we have for this cycle. We have 10 meetings designed in. That's a doable thing in a year basis, yearly basis. I think, to be very blunt about it, there is some concern and about the administrative budget and doing that on an annual basis and the risk at which it puts the council. We testified, and accurately so, that because the administrative budget was in the recommendations, you had the ability, I didn't put it this way, you had the ability to eliminate the council staff and thereby eliminate the council in the recommendation process. Mm-hmm. If you keep the recommendation for administrative budget on an annual basis. So I guess my feeling about it is at this point in time, we're better off and are capable of doing an annual allocation with the proviso that we consider some specific things being done over 2 years so that we retain the authority to spread large projects over 2 years, to put the administrative budget over 2 years, if they make that recommendation over 2 years, if the council agrees.
Other thoughts from council members. Brian?
A lot of what we fund is programs, not specific projects. We're funding an acquisition program, and we're not the ones that are necessarily making decisions what individual projects are being funded. There's some, we worry about losing projects. If it's funded over 2 years and there's, and you know next year I've got this program is going to have this much funding too, it helps you plan and account for those projects to pop up. Say next year I'm going to have this X revenue, so you can go make a contingent offer to a landlord, for instance, because you know following July 1 you've got another pot of money that's going to be available to you for the program. So I don't know if it's necessarily 1 year versus 2 year budgeting makes us less nimble. In some cases it makes it might make the acquisition programs like that more nimble. Certainly understand everyone else in state government is working on 2 year biennial budgets. So we're fairly unique in that sense. And I don't mind being unique, but I don't want to be too much of an outlier and put our funding proposals at risk, you know, in second year budgets. You know, our budget this year was an omnibus finance bill, and a best case scenario, the legislature doesn't do finance bill within off years, they do bonding bills. And we'd be the only funding package, we were the only major funding package, every other package was a cutting package this year. But, I think there's some real benefits in only a 2 year cycle.
Scott?
Well, my history with NGOs, it doesn't work like that because the list is of acquisitions and the list of projects is long, way longer than the available funding is. So when they get funded, they go out and they fill that document. They make commitments, okay, just to occupy or to spend that money. Okay, so if a really good project came up 8 months later, okay, it's going to wait 2 years to be funded because all of those dollars are going to have been committed at the fastest possible rate to those landowners that are willing sellers. Okay, so I don't know that they're going to go, they're going to make offers or enter into negotiations with landowners and then say, oh, by the way, your project isn't very good anymore. You find a better one, we're going to dump you and do somebody else. Okay, I don't see that happening, but I think that the vast majority of the partners that we work with, and there's been a few of them, and it's maybe some of the bigger ones, you know, that are taking on larger shares of the funding that might think a two-year funding cycle is okay. But I don't think they're going to stop applying or stop doing good work if we stay with a one-year program.
Dave, you had your hand up. I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say LCCMR does the administrative budget for 2 years in the first year, just to avoid that problem. When we got into it, even you end up with layoff notices when you don't have your second year funding for the staff. You actually have to inform them that they may lose their jobs because you don't have any money allocated to pay them after July 1st. So at LCCMR, we were doing, even though we were on annual cycles, we were doing some of the things for 2 years. Would seem to me that we could do certainly some things like that and conservation partners.
Mm-hmm.
You could allocate for 2 years. So you don't have to go. The other part of this is if you do 2 year cycle instead of 1 year cycle, you're only fighting the battle at the legislature once, which is a big deal. For those that spend a lot of time at it, they can tell you what a big deal it is. But I understand the being nimble part of it. The truth is that anybody that we funded in 2011, we don't get to see if they're doing anything by the time we're going to hear their proposal, because they will have started to be able to do anything in July 1st, and we're going to be hearing their work in August. So it isn't working in terms of, you can go back an extra year, but you can't see those that get money out of what the work we did last year. We're not going to see when we're ready to make decisions if they've done anything.
Darby?
David has really answered my question. Was really, what, you know, based on the LCCMR experience, you know, what's your advice?
You know, on a selfish basis, I'd like to do it once every 2 years because the process is huge. I understand the nimble part of it. I think it's harder to be nimble in the second year because if we had a Forest Legacy project for $40 million that came in the second year, the likelihood we'd spend half of our budget in a year on one project is slim. Where if it's at the beginning of the biennium, you know, it's easier to make those kinds of big allocations. So, I think it's something that at some point we're going to get to. Whether we get to it in this cycle, I don't know. But I think there are a lot of reasons why in the long term it makes sense. Maybe you do it where you increase the Conservation Partners funding so that you have that on an annual cycle, but do your big allocations to your big programs on a, or the Conservation Partners is flowing money out to nonprofits on a once or twice a year basis over the biennium. But your big programs, your funding, and your partners know they have it, and it's a stable deal for them for 2 years. They don't have to go back and fight for the money.
Wayne?
Since this is a significant change in the way we've been doing business, and I don't know about everybody else, but I'd like to know what some of the different options might be. We talked about potential options. Would it be appropriate to do the call for request for 2012 and make that determination today, and then in a month, next meeting, put the proposal back together and say, start the 13 a month later? I mean, do we have to make that decision today, or can we have this decision spread out a month from now?
No.
I think in the interest of full disclosure, since between this meeting and the next meeting, we'll be issuing the call for requests, we need to come to some conclusion on how we're going to phrase what our intent is so that people know what we intend to do. I don't think that we necessarily have to be deterministic, however.
Let me suggest something. Well, I'm sorry, Bob?
Just out of curiosity, I can't remember ever discussing this, but in the bonding bill, for example, if a project spends less money than they say they're going to, that money is returned to the general fund. If a project is not completed at all within a certain specified period of time, the money is grabbed back and put in the general fund unless there's a bill to continue.
Right.
What do we have in this regard? If we're going to go for 2 years, at what point in time, if a project doesn't start, are we going to say, wait a minute, that money is ours, not yours, and it's ours in this case, going by what you wanted to talk about, David, it is Lessard, Sam's Out There Heritage Councils, not the state's. And I think that subject I've never heard it brought up, has it been?
The appropriations, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Bill?
The appropriations are, in the first 2 years, limited to 2 years or 3 years of availability, depending on whether they're acquisitions or restoration and enhancements. I think the practical intent of that in the Department of Finance is that the appropriations are available for 3 years. Mm-hmm. This bill that we recently passed, in the second year, the first year they're available for 2 or 3 years. The bill that we just recently passed has restoration and enhancement available for 5 years.
Right.
At the end of this, that time, it goes back into the fund and can be reappropriated.
You know, I'm sensitive to what the 97A says. I mean, I don't disagree with everything I've heard here, but the law currently says that we shall develop recommendations to the Senate and House of Representatives, blah, 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 by February 15th in the odd-numbered years and within the first 4 weeks of the legislative session in the even-numbered years. And so, I mean, I don't want to put ourselves in a position where we get criticized. And I'd say if this council, if it's the decision that we really want to move to a two-year, that we include that in our recommendations going forward as a rider language to change 97A. And that in the interim, that we deal with a council administrative budget
and possibly the Conservation Partners Program for 2 years. And the other reason for that, a concern about opening it up for some for 2 years and some for one, is then it might give, it might diminish the role of the council, and we might see legislative appropriations filling up the remainder of that biennium. And I'm really nervous about that, less so than I was a year ago. So if the council wishes to go to a two-year, my recommendation would be that we ask for that authority in law so we don't get crossways with certain legislators, and then depending on if they agree with it, then we can start doing that next in 2 years. And if they don't, then it's a good reason that we don't go to a two-year right now.
And I would say I'm happy with anything. I think the discussion is healthy. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably too much for us to make any decision to change things today based on a 15-minute discussion. Okay. And we should have this discussion again before we get to the end of the year. And we don't have to do it this year. We can do it next year as well. But I think the discussion is healthy in terms of what works for a process. I would like to put everyone on notice that I at least will recommend that the administrative budget at a minimum is covered for 2 years in this year's appropriation.
Yep.
Second that.
Yep. Any further thoughts on this item? If not, I'd like to move to the item B, which is our draft call for requests.
And Mr. Chair,
Bill,
I'd like to ask Heather Koop to briefly run through the documents in your packet.
Mm-hmm.
Heather?
Did we get this one done?
No, we got to go back and approve it.
I don't know. Document. And second is a single page titled minimum screening criteria. Staff at work the last several weeks and prior to that, the last several months, thinking about ways in which to make this process easier for the user to understand and easier for staff to take the data and to analyze it. We've talked with a number of project managers about the call for requests and what their thoughts were. We've run a number of different scenarios. And so what you see before you is an attempt to try to streamline that call for request and thus streamline the process a little bit more as well. The document is taken from last year's call for requests, and we just simply did a strikeout insertion method in a variety of calls here for you to take a look at. What we're asking today for your approval to make the changes that we see as necessary to help to streamline this process. One of the things that I worked on was trying to reorder the calls, make it seem to control a little bit easier, and put like pieces together so that one comes to the document would have an easier time navigating and understanding it. And a big part of that was the minimum screening criteria, which is listed on the single sheet before you. Essentially, what we have done here is not change the content of call for requests, but rather to be reorder it, reword it, condense it, and synthesize it for the user, as I stated. So the minimum screening criteria has been moved to an earlier part of the document. The proposal requirements have been regrouped with like items, and really only condensed one item. So the various questions, I'm more than happy to answer them, but I think it's definitely fairly self-explanatory.
Okay.
Just to get discussion on the table, I move that we approve this.
Thank you. So we have a motion to approve the call for funding request for 2012 as drafted. Now, discussion. So questions for Heather, first of all. So a number of changes, but the changes are largely cosmetic, just shifting things here and there.
Mr. Chair, the content, as I said, does not change, but one thing I did fail to mention is that we are moving to a semi-web-based
quorum for the request for the call for the funding request. Sandy worked really hard writing code and language, and we have it on the record that this is another way in which we can make this process much more transparent and much more accessible for the users. It's much easier for the staff to take the data and to put it together and synthesize it. There is a website, the LSHC website, where we a main application page, and there will be a number of attachments that the user would fill out there and send them to the staff. What you're seeing here now is simply a rough draft, Sandy's worked really hard too to make what we call the pretty computer. So it will be a much more visually pleasing call for funding report that will be on the web with photographs and nice type ways and different pieces of font and whatnot. But this is our working copy right here.
Wayne?
Is it the yellow is added words? Except for where it's added and then deleted with the red being stricken?
On page 3 to page 3, it says the address number 2 and 3 above.
Yeah, and then if you go to the back sections of priorities, there was a word, the comparable fish and are those all added words?
I'm going to talk about that in just a second, okay. But I wanted to talk about the funding form separately, the strategy revision.
The other question I have for you is, we're on the first three pages right now, correct? On page, it's not numbered, but it's the actually the fourth page, so it's the short page. You have strikeouts. So we have 19 minimum criteria?
No, if you take, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, this would be the insertion. There would be the insertion, and then it's everything that you see on pages 3. The section on page 3 that starts with LSOHC will consider funding such that everything from that point on would be deleted and this would be inserted.
I see. I have. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
We wanted to make sure that you saw both because it would be easier to understand. We thought it would be easier to understand.
Got it. Okay. David, given the treasurer's report, I'm wondering if you'd be willing to make a motion to modify on page 1. The council is currently estimating it says $82 million. Given your report, to propose to amend this to $86 million, consistent with your report.
I would be delighted to accept that amendment.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion on the first part that Heather just presented. Everyone understand the insert? Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. Heather?
The second piece then is the council's funding outcomes and priorities statement. And this is what I believe I think about last year prior to the funding outcome request coming out. We sent this around a couple of months ago and asked for the council input to see if these priorities still help with the progression of the council itself. We should go forward with the next round of recommended appropriations. What you see before you here then in parentheses are those council members who submitted changes or suggestions and the initial attached to it.
Because I'm not adopting.
I believe you've all had a chance to take a look at this. And what we're looking for today then is your agreement or not or with the recommended
comments, questions? One of the things I asked, Bob, did you have your hand up? One of the things I asked Greg and Bill to work on, given the change in the legislation that dealt with use of outdoor heritage dollars for acquisition where there's a partial or whole interest in public, state or local units of government, I've asked them to look at some possible language to include in our call to make it abundantly clear about that provision in law as it relates to the call. So Bill, Greg, did you any success?
Mr. Chair, we talked it over and think that the best thing to do to ensure that people who are responding are aware of this is to, on the page where it says LSOHC will only consider funding requests that, and then there's a list, extensive list of up to 20 items. And number one is, are consistent with the uses of OHF as specified in Article 11 of the Minnesota Constitution and Minnesota statutes and law, that we direct them to the pertinent statute by adding the clause, including restriction on acquisition of lands in the public domain as required by Minnesota Statutes 2010, Section 97A.056, Subdivision 9.
And, Greg, that worked for you?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We would need a motion then to amend this proposal or this call for request along the lines of what Bill just read.
How about I just incorporate that into
Would you be willing to do that? Thank you. All right. Further discussion on the call. Any thoughts? Last chance. We have a motion on the floor as amended by the budget of this last item on number one of the minimum criteria. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor of adopting the call for request for 2012 as amended and as drafted, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. We have our call. This call will go out June 1st, and it will be out for 45 days. Great. Thank you. Great work by staff. Thanks to all members who provided staff input.
Now, Mr. Chair, that's not going to include our little notes that we have. Yeah. It's just going to include...
Bill.
We will go forward with the usual instructions to make the changes necessary to reflect what the council wants.
All right. We're moving on now to decision item or action agenda item number 8, which is a decision item, and that is our operating procedure amendment. Bill.
I'll very quickly take you through the document that is titled Operating Procedures of the Lasard Sands Outdoor Heritage Council, and better known as the, or commonly known as the council. And first of all the changes on page one are perfunctory changes, simply changing the reference to LOHC Council. Likewise, on page 2, these are technical changes, getting capitalization correct, with the exception of election of officers B, which is changing the term of the chair from June, ending in June of the odd-numbered year, to ending in the first Monday in January of the odd-numbered year. This is being done, and I think that that should read even number year.
Right.
So on page 2, under election of officers B, at the end of line 1, change odd to even.
No,
oh,
no.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that was the first round of elections.
Right. I'm confused as to what century it is.
Yeah, you've got it right.
So to change it from 1st June, which would be the upcoming June, to the January of the odd-numbered year. The purpose of this change is to avoid splitting chairs in the middle of an allocation process and having one chair do the work in spring, and there's a considerable amount of work in spring and early summer to get ready for a call for requests and then change chairs right in the middle of it. It also makes the chair's
is that a motion?
Term likely consistent with the term of their appointment to the council.
So that's the first major change. Then on page 3, these are perfunctory except for quorum requirements, where the quorum is redefined as half of the qualified members plus one in the event that we have less than 12 members on the council at the time of election. Changes on page 4 are perfunctory with the exception of, I wanted to point out the revised audit language that is that was a result of amendments made in laws of 2009, Chapter 172. And then on page 5, under the chair's duties, we have more clearly spelled out the duty of authorizing travel. Specifically for travel outside of the regular council or committee business meetings, and it defines a method by which a member may request to be reimbursed for travel and the requirements of that request and who authorizes it. So the remainder of page 5 is technical. The remainder of page 6 is technical. The remainder of page 7 is technical. So what you have before you is essentially a revision of the election cycle and a definition of how to request travel outside the regular council travel. Meeting travel.
Thank you, Bill. David.
Page 6, Executive Committee, number 1. Executive Committee, forget I just said that.
So the practical effect of the change in the election of officers is that the current slate of officers would continue until January. The challenge is that if this goes through, then the council may be a council of 8. Because our terms end in early January, there's 4 of us whose terms end in early January, and it's very unlikely, just given past practice, that new members will be appointed immediately. And so you may have a council of 8 to choose to select your new members. So just be aware that you may not have the full 12. And for sure, of the 4 that are going off now, or going off in January, they're all citizen members. 1 from the House, 1 from the Senate, and 2 appointed by the governor. So that somewhat restricts the pool of candidates for officers.
But they're going to be restricted anyhow.
Well, it could be that these people become appointed, the new members get appointed, let's say March, I don't know, and at which time you may have some people you wish would have been available to consider for nomination as an officer. You just won't have that. Further discussion on the proposed amendments to our operating procedures. Everyone's comfortable with those changes? We need a motion to adopt the operating procedures as amended. Okay. Further discussion on that motion.
Term limits.
That's 2 of you I've heard that from. Hearing no further discussion, all those in favor of revising the operating procedures as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Those of you in the audience, thanks for your patience. We are now at the time where we're going to take public comments. So thanks for participating in the meeting, Bill. I'll turn it over to you at this point.
We've got number 1 on the list. We've got the following people: Brad Mergens, I believe that's correct, Daryl Newville, and John Reuschlin. So can we start with Brad, please? Just step up and state your name for the record.
Brad Mergens. I'm the district manager with the Western Conservation District here in Curtis Falls.
the end of the first. Greater distance for increased
while ago. And there's just a couple paragraphs down below that obviously show that the increase with your buffer strip is going to increase your wildlife population as well as the diversity of your wildlife. So to summarize, I think you know, this partnership with USDA, Clean Water, folks, Clean Water dollars, and council dollars is really going to meet with the public when they approve the amendments. Seeing both, you know, all three groups working together, the USDA, the legislature, and the Clean Water, putting the resources together and all the goals can be met. Instead of, you know, fragmenting and putting clean water buffers along our protected water courses and with minimum width, we can again partner and increase the use and do a bigger bang for the buck.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Mr. Bergeson, I'm not sure what you're basically saying is right now we got buffer areas along rivers using the Clean Water Fund, and that's creating a very narrow strip which may be protecting waters, but it's not a real good thing for wildlife. So by expanding that area out to go beyond the 50-foot buffer, we're actually going to be doing clean water, and we'll have a better wildlife habitat project at the same time, so we're getting twice the bang for a buck.
Yes, correct.
Mr. Cox?
Do you think these 600-foot buffers would be as well accepted as the 50 or 100-foot buffers? And how is this payment made? Is it a one-time payment or is it a yearly payment? Or?
Yes, the rim payment is a one-time lump sum payment for professional easements. Of that area out 400, 500, 600 feet, it may or may not fully be enrolled in the CRP. But the popularity of the existing clean water program is because the landowner is receiving an existing CRP payment, and which is a limited duration easement. And we're coming on top of that with the perpetual rent easement.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Newville. Nice to see you again today.
My name is Darren Newville. I'm the district manager for the East Ottertail Soil and Water located out of Pearl. And Brad and I have been working together on both of these concepts. Soil and Water Conservation Districts, we're the people that deliver the programs, a lot of the programs, to private landowners. We have a unique relationship with USDA and Board of Water Soil Resources, different federal and city groups. We work very closely with our NRCS counterparts to deliver their programs and the state programs. So we're coming to you guys as people in the field delivering the programs, telling you what we're seeing. One of the programs that USDA has is the Wildlife Habitat Incentive Program. And that's a cost-share program to pay landowners to do habitat projects on their private property. One of the problems that we run into this last year is just in Ottertail County alone, we had 44 potential projects for about $234,000 that didn't get funded because of the lack of funding coming through NRCS. One of the problems that we have coming to the LASART Council is you guys have a priority of putting dollars on projects that are protected through acquisition or some type of easement. Most of these RIP projects aren't eligible for CRP. They're not eligible for RIM because they don't meet the criteria. And I think that we could get these people to do protection through something less than an easement or acquisition, maybe a deed restriction or a covenant that would protect the property, and then provide them with cost share to restore those properties and enhance those properties with wildlife habitat practices. And we have a whole list of different practices that we have set standards for that we can use for that. So in your future considerations, our boards have talked about this, and we would like to see if you would maybe consider something less than a perpetual easement or a fee acquisition that would still protect the property saving money, because with these 44 applications, that was about 400 acres of these habitat that we've got. If we were just to put easements on those properties, that would be almost $900,000 in easement fees just for the easements. That's not the processing, the recording, or anything like that before you plant one seed, one shelter, boom, you know. We could do that for about $250,000. So it's a huge savings. You're getting habitat, you're getting protection. You know, we could have a criteria set up where we could try to focus on habitat complexes, where we could move out from something that's already there and restore properties as we go.
Other questions for Mr. Newbills?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Brian.
One of the things that a number of people brought up with me last year was, well, there was objections to the wetland reserve program land projects because there was no public access. There is concerns people have that why are we using government money to fund private restoration that benefits, you know, essentially private hunting properties. Any recommendations on what I tell those guys?
There are some easements that don't have public access. This is just spreading dollars for as an idea. We could possibly get more habitat on the ground without having to spend the easement dollars.
So let me kind of carry that thought one step further, which would be a question I've had is, what's the legacy that we want to leave?
Again, it would be protected through that covenant or deed restriction.
But isn't that the same as an easement?
We wouldn't be have to pay for it. Because, like I said, these...
Would it be a perpetual covenant or...
It could be a perpetual covenant. It could be a perpetual deed restriction. You know, it could be a contract of some sort. You know, and I don't know if the, you know, statutorily that would be acceptable, but that would be the legacy. If you could do some type of deed restriction, it would be perpetual in nature.
David?
I think the question I'd have is, an easement is has someone who is there enforcing it, and a deed restriction becomes a hidden thing and it isn't enforced on a... Not that all easements are enforced, but I mean, there's an affirmative obligation to go out and ensure that there is compliance every year.
And when we
covenant and deed restriction,
and when we do the easements, we're the local agency that does the remedies, the Soil and Water Conservation District deliver those. We're the ones that are charged with going out there and inspecting those projects. So with a deed restriction, I think it would be a similar thing where we would be going out there and, you know, when we do a project, we always inspect it the first year it's done. Try to make sure that we're providing technical assistance as we go. We're inspecting it that first year when it's done. With rim easements, we usually go back the second year. And I would see something similar to that where we would be going back and inspecting those things periodically every three to 5 years and helping that landowner manage that problem so that legacy is there, what we said we were going to put on the ground is there.
So just help me understand this, because what you're essentially saying is that through an easement that permanently restricts development rights, you have to pay for it. But a deed restriction or covenant that does exactly the same thing, the landowner isn't going to expect anything for that?
Because these properties are not eligible through some of these programs. They wouldn't be eligible for the RIM program because right now, with the clean water portion of it, or even the RIM WRP that has to be restorable level, these could be things off to the side over in the hills or a small area next to a wetland complex that may not meet that criteria for that specific program.
So why wouldn't you do an easement that you don't pay for?
That could potentially... Why don't that could potentially be something that would be there, but it would be a large processing thing with the covenant. It's easier to report. There's a lot of tax programs right now that you may have heard of the Rural Preserve Program, some of the forest tax incentive programs have a deed restriction or a covenant placed on that, and it would be a simple form that we could fill out right in our office, take it to the recorder's office instead of having to send it through Follinger to have them process it. It would be a simpler process.
I don't want to dominate here, but one of the advantages of an easement that you don't pay for is it's deductible to the landowner. I don't think the covenant would be. They could take a tax deduction on a donated easement. I don't think you could take a tax deduction on a donated covenant. You'd have to check that out. Right.
Scott?
You know, the projects that you speak about, WIP, I'm familiar with that project. And the types of projects that I would envision that you would want to do, if all of a sudden, it would be very difficult, but if all of a sudden that funding became available and you had 400 of them, okay, where would the funds come to oversee that and go inspect that? And are you going to come back then and say, oh, you know, you guys funded this, we got these easements, now we need an appropriation for enforcement or management? Does your office have enough staff and enough free time?
I would go back to where do the funds come from for us to do our real inspections. I get about $200 a year to go out and do real inspections from the state of Minnesota, but I'm still required to go do them.
So you didn't answer my question. Where would the money come from to fund the inspections of these 400 projects if they were funded? On an annual basis or every 3 years or however often you go out and do that, would that come out of your current operating budget of your district?
It would probably come out of our current operating budget of our district. The way districts are funded, I don't know if you guys have a lot of background with sort of water conservation districts. We get our funding in three different ways. We get allocations from the state. Some of those are general service dollars, which our district keeps the doors open to be there for the public. We get funding from the county, which, you know, can go up and down based on the county budgets, but most of the time they're fairly stable. We have that. And the third way we do it is we generate it through our own programs. You know, we have, in Otter County, we have an irrigation scheduler program. We go out and we help irrigators, you know, help manage their land. Some of us have tree programs or seeding programs, different things like that, that help generate those funds. That's how we're funded. You know, we would like to get more funding from the state for doing these things, but of course, we all know where their state budget is right now. It's one of those things which probably have to be addressed in the future. Yeah.
I've heard Brian Sonnertail FSA has a bunch of
You've got 5 minutes for rebuttal, Wayne.
I'm digging.
Any further comments, Darren?
Just something for you guys to consider.
Great.
Yeah. It's a problem that my board has said, we see this problem. The LaSart Council is there. They have some potential funding there. Can you go to them and ask them for at least a consideration to take a look at something like these types of projects that wouldn't be eligible for these other programs?
We appreciate you taking the time to bring the message.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Mr. Rothschild? Rothschild?
Sorry, my writing's not very clear on that point.
Old Boy to Sioux Watershed District?
That's correct. I'm not sure I've got enough of these for everybody, so maybe some of you will have to share. First of all, welcome to the River Valley. Believe it or not, the water that would run off of this particular piece of ground would end up ultimately in Red River North. That's probably a landlocked basin.
It is.
So, I want to talk to you today a little bit about how watershed districts do work in the Red River Valley. Watersheds in the Red River Valley are charged with providing primarily flood damage reduction measures to our residents, constituents, and communities of the valley. We're also charged with doing natural resource enhancements. I've got two examples of projects that watershed districts do in the Red River Valley, or types of projects that we do in the valley, to do both of those. We do multi-purpose projects. One of the projects that you're getting a brochure on is already built. The other one is on the drawing board. And I've also got a poster up in the back. I'm not going to allude too much about the specifics of these projects, but if you look at the North Ottawa project brochure, it's on the back side of this panel right here. It talks about the second objective, by feeding and resting habitat for migratory birds, mudflat feeding areas and shore birds, so on and so forth. I'll let you read that on your own. Redpath project is being designed to do somewhat the same thing. The reason we try to maximize these natural resource enhancements is to maximize our funding opportunities to get them built. These aren't your typical restoration projects, but they are projects that do enhance the natural resources and the habitat in the Redwood Valley. Both of these projects are being built on what was considered as agricultural land, cultivated agricultural land. It's small portions of the small percentage of the ag land being taken out of production and put into these types of projects. Now, in the case of the Red Path project, and as is still in the case of the North Ottawa project, we have cultivated agriculture incorporated in those as well. So, the Red Path project, for example, I feel is going to be truly a multi-purpose project with flood damage reduction, water quality improvement, habitat enhancement. We're even talking about a fish spawning area in one pool for Northern Pike, and cultivated agriculture, so everybody kind of lives in harmony. In my opinion, this is these types of projects that we're looking at building or that we have built is another opportunity for Outdoor Heritage Council funding to be used to enhance habitat, enhance wildlife, improve water quality in our state, and primarily in the Red River Valley out here anyways. And I would like to ask that you consider proposals that come forth that do just that. Proposals that I would submit would be for the natural resource enhancement components. That's the type of funding money you guys are handling. My flood damage reduction components would be proposed to, like, say, the flood damage reduction program through the state, there's money allocated to the state funding program for that. It just seems like a good fit. And that's, in a nutshell, what I wanted to speak with you about. I've been in contact with Mr. Bench a few times. He's been to a couple of our board meetings, and I just thought, as long as you guys were this close, I'd like to come up and visit with you about it. Answer questions if you have any.
Thank you. Thanks. Any questions? Ryan?
How cooperative are the local units of government and the counties on these projects?
We, when we develop these projects in the Red River Valley, we have to establish a project team, and they are members of that project team, and they have a voice on that. The project team acts as an advisory position to the watershed district boards, which make the ultimate decision when we have these things like this. But we operate on a consensus. Everybody has to get to a point where they say they can live with it, whatever is being proposed. In the case of these two projects, North Ottawa, which is a $19 million project, Red Path is estimated at $29 million. Everybody on the project teams for both of these have signed a consent form saying, yes, I can live with that proposal.
Do they expand the game? Are they investing?
Well, the counties don't necessarily invest funds into this. They, directly. The residents of the watershed districts do pay a property tax that a part of it, that is used as a local share of funding to gather as seed money, so to speak, when we have to match funds from the Red River Watershed Management Board or the State Water and Reduction Program or, say, Corps of Engineers to assist money. We generate that some of that locally with our own districts. I guess I'm not sure where you're trying to go with your question, but the common boards per se, we don't go to them and say, can you give us $100,000 for this project? No, we don't do that.
Well, it strikes me there's some counties, I want to say Grant County, a little hostile for the acquisition of the project, but in the area that would certainly be beneficial long term to wetland mitigation and other things. Some wildlife management area proposals have been rejected by county boards. So I'm just curious, what conservation projects the county boards are interested in and willing to support. I guess from my perspective, looking at these projects, there certainly is wildlife benefit. If proposals come through and they're tied, show me how it fits into the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's thunderstorm map, and I can get real excited about these projects.
Kevin sits on our project teams, and counterparts down in the other wetland management district also participated in that, so we pay real close attention to what they're telling us, too. Funny you should mention Grant County. That's where North Ottawa is located. These projects, because they're multi-purpose, it's not just the habitat or just the natural resource benefits that you're getting. You're getting some flood damage reduction benefits. Face it, in the Red River Valley, our main economy is agriculture. And when we can keep the roads from being damaged and costing the counties a lot to be fixed after a spring runoff so that the farmers can get their crops to market, when we can prevent summer storm events from wiping out a crop by spreading 6 inches of water across 15 square miles, which is what that picture is on the front, 15 square miles of 6 inches of water, and wiping out 15 square miles of crop, there's some benefit there economically to the counties. And we're not all about anti-drainage. We know drainage is needed, but we need to do it in an organized and managed way. If we can provide outlets for agricultural drainage, we prevent flood damages from happening to them plus other people. So it's a tangled web, but we try to lead it.
Any other further questions? Les?
John, you look at when you start out with an impoundment project, you look at the overall concept of the entire program as impoundment, restoration, preservation. So you're looking at, are you looking at your initial plans as creating a habitat complex? Or is it the impoundment is your number one objective in many cases?
These two projects were opportunity driven. We had land being for sale to earlier sellers, and we took a look at it to see if it would be a good spot to pull water on for flood damage reduction. Once we've got that figured out, that yes, it will work good for flood damage reduction, then we say, how can we enhance these projects for natural resource purposes? And a lot of times, locating these projects where we're located, there's tons of opportunities to make it better. I don't know if I answered your question, but we do, our primary purpose as a watershed district is for flood damage reduction. But since 1998, without going into the long detail of our mediation process that we did and the agreement that we reached, watershed districts have also placed natural resource enhancement right up there alongside as a priority. So always in our minds, we're keeping in mind how can we enhance the natural resources of these projects for like water quality, fish habitat, feeding and resting areas, maybe even some nesting habitat. I believe we're going to go tour a project with my counterpart, Bruce Albright, tomorrow, the Manson Slough, which is a large, more of a, it's probably got more habitat involved than it does flood damage reduction, but it does both. So, you know, we try to balance that. That's why we have the project team process, and we've got all walks of life and all interests involved in that discussion.
The publicity that the Red River Basin watershed gets in this area is quite significant. And we're all familiar with the Hershey project. In your estimation, do you feel that the restoration projects and the impoundment projects in the different watersheds and across the North Dakota border have the capability to do a significant mitigation on that problem?
As far as reducing any of the downstream effects of that Fargo-Moorhead diversion project, yes. Our engineering firm is, we've charged him with doing some extensive review and modeling. We believe that in our district it's doable to reduce the flows on the Red River by 20%. We're talking about a 200,000 acre foot retention. We've identified 26 different sites in our watershed district alone that we'd be capable of doing that, reaching that goal. As far as eliminating the need for a diversion in part of the Moorhead, no, I don't think we can do it with retention. But I think we can balance it so that it doesn't have to be quite as extensive, maybe. It would minimize, if not eliminate, the downstream effects of passing that water around the community, and, you know, a faster way, fashion. All the model information that we've been developing and running says yes, it's possible.
Well, of the 26 projects, we've got basically willing sellers, willing landowners. How long do you think it would take to complete all these projects? Is it even feasible?
Oh, it's feasible to do. Right now, we've been operating and developing these projects based on willing seller coming forward to us and saying, hey, we got some land for sale, or we find it in the paper. The Red Path project has actually been a lot easier to discuss with the landowners about selling or trading their property since they've seen the North Ottawa project on the ground working. It's kind of a loaded question, but we haven't talked to all the landowners on these sites. We haven't even gotten site specific on those, but we do feel comfortable with the fact that we can control the sub watersheds that we've identified where control needs to be done. And we can provide that 20% reduction in flow.
Just one follow-up question, and I'll end it. In the areas where you're looking at habitat, surrounding areas, creating the habitat complex, are you looking at multiple use as those lands, or are you looking at strictly easements without any agricultural uses, limited farming, limited grazing?
Yeah, I think it would be limited uses. If we're going to do some grazing, maybe do some grazing as management for vegetation control, maybe some farming for vegetation control as a management tool. Right now, with these two projects, we're looking at total fee title ownership of the land, and then if we're going to do some grazing in there, we would have a custom graze or something like that, or let somebody come in and lease it for grazing. Farming the same way.
Who holds the title?
Right now, the Watershed District does. North Ottawa Project, the Watershed District owns all the property. We've currently got 2 of the 3 square miles leased out for farming until we finish the construction of the final phase of that project.
Any other questions or comments? Yeah, Bill.
Have you... You probably even mentioned this already, but have you had any flood mitigation dollars from the federal government at all? Because I know they're looking at spending a lot of money on Morehead for diversion.
We haven't been able to. I haven't even been privy to know of any programs through flood mitigation, like through FEMA or anything, where we could give them to build these types of projects. We are working with the Corps of Engineers on. Their continuing authorities program number 206. It's an aquatic ecosystem restoration type thing where they'll come in and retrofit in the North Ottawa project some management facilities so we can maneuver water around and manage it for feeding and resting areas. So that, for example, we'll reduce the turbidity in the water because it sits long enough and it settles out and we can let the water out. Plus some stream flow augmentation. It's just building some dikes and some structures inside that project so that we can open and close gates and move water around inside.
So there has been no inquiry at all with the federal government for any mitigation dollars through FEMA? I mean, they're spending lots of money on the Red River flood every year. I'm
right.
Just
their mitigation money is not, as far as I understand, has not been available for projects such as this. They're too... And I'm a little confused with it because I don't know quite how to access it for projects that are talking $19 million in the making or $29 million.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
I would encourage you, John, and the others who have testified this afternoon to apply. The application period is open on June the 1st and open for 45 days. So we look forward to hearing from you again.
Yes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
I've got 2 extra brochures. Did I get one?
Is there anyone else who wants to provide any comments to the Lessard-Sams Outdoor Heritage Council? All right. Well, again, thank you for showing up and spending time this afternoon and evening with us. A motion to adjourn.
Motion made.
Further discussion?
No.
Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adjourned. Meeting is adjourned. Thank you. And now.